Now it's my great pleasure to introduce to you Father Richard Rohr. Father Richard is a Franciscan of the New Mexico province, an internationally known author and teacher, and the founding director of the Center for Action and Contemplation. He considers the proclamation of the gospel to be his primary call, and the related themes he addresses include eco-spirituality, scripture as liberation, the integration of action and contemplation, community building, peace and justice issues, male spirituality, non-dual consciousness, and the Enneagram. He's a regular contributing writer for Sojourners and Tikkun magazines, and his recently published books include The Naked Now, Wondrous Encounters, and Falling Upward. Please welcome Father Richard Rohr.
Good morning. Thank you, Cece. And Cheryl and Suzanne, thank you for joining and filling out whatever I'm going to try to say. I must start by saying I'm more than a bit surprised that people come or even trust a book with this kind of title. We all have a fear of falling. I think that's inherent. But for those who understand Jesus at all, we also have a little mistrust of any talk of upward, because we know that very much appeals to the ego, the part of us that really doesn't want God, but just wants ourself. And nevertheless, we put them together in this title. When I first gave it to Cheryl, I thought, sure, and I think maybe you did too, that, well, this had to have been used a dozen times already. But actually, it hadn't been. There is a children's book, Falling Upwards by Shel Silverstein, with an S on the end, but there was no adult book. So I hope that the title itself maybe is what first intrigued you. And what I'm going to try to do in this hour is unpackage the main structure, themes, direction. And let me tell you why I finally wrote the book. As some of you know, many years ago, in fact, here at Hotel Albuquerque, Paula D'Arcy and I did a conference on the spirituality of the two halves of life. Then later in Houston, I did another conference with Ron Rollheiser on the same theme, approaching it a little different in both cases, but fluffing out the same material. And then in the subsequent last 10 years on the road, I must say, without any exaggeration, in the question and answer period, at the end of conferences, even conferences on very different subjects, reference to these ideas would end up answering maybe one-third of the questions. And any of you who have been at those conferences, you know it's true. And apparently the answers were even somewhat satisfying to people. Oh, that's why that's a problem for us. Because we don't largely distinguish from what I call and others ahead of me have called the major two tasks of life. Certainly there's many smaller tasks. And we all know there's something dangerous about making it too neat and too clear. It never is that way. As Spiral Dynamics is saying today, life is much more a spiral. And as many people say, it's three steps forward and two steps backward. And that's a more honest stating. But for the sake of some kind of clarity about where we're being led, what two things have to happen to get there, Carl Jung's phrase, the two halves of life, has ended up being very helpful. So let's start there. And all I can do in this hour is try to give a little overview of, first of all, what do we mean by the first half? Maybe the most important is how, why, if, when, where do we transition from the first to the second? And why don't a lot of people do it? And then, if I dare to try to talk about it, what does the second half of life start to feel like? So that's the overview. So let me dive right in. And maybe I'll start with what I have in the very frontispiece of the book, again from Carl Jung. And I think it's a quote that hardly anybody disagrees with once they think about it. He says, the greatest and most important problems of life are fundamentally unsolvable. They can never be solved. They are only outgrown. Now, why I like a line like that is not for the psychological truth, but actually the theological truth, that what it's saying is we're dealing with mystery, and mystery with a big M, the big mystery that those of us from the religious background would call God. And that mystery is always by necessity and by definition unsolvable. It's not ours to solve. It's a mystery we surrender to, and somehow in that surrendering, there is a different kind of knowing. And one of the marvelous things about living in our time, especially ironically through the field of science, is the discovery of what religion initially intuited, that there are different ways of knowing, and that the so-called rational left brain, so-called logical way of knowing is just one, and maybe not necessarily always the best. That discovery in itself is largely what moves you to the second half of life. And the wonderful thing about our time, and I mean this sincerely, is I think a high percentage of people are moving there, almost by the force of, I think, the absurdity, the tragedy, the illogicality, if that's a word, of the world that we live in. The modernist project, which some say ended around 1968, was all based on the assumption that we inherited from the Enlightenment of the 17th and 18th centuries, that all you had to do was get people educated, and things would get better and better and better. All you needed to do was give people knowledge and information. This book right now is being translated into German, where I'll be in a few weeks in Germany. And there, every time I go, I discover among this people and this nation that many have considered the most educated people in the world, the highest educational system, perhaps, of most countries, that's where total absurdity happened. And they're overwhelmingly aware of that. How could we have it so right and yet fall into so wrong? And a country that was nominally Christian, Lutheran and Catholic. Could it be, and that's part of what I'm trying to say in the book, that we didn't understand the message itself about falling, and we tried to go upward without falling first? And as I say, and this is what our initiation rites discovered too, is that if you don't learn about powerlessness, you will always, and I think this is rather provable at this point, you will always abuse power. You don't know how to handle power. Every initiation rite cross-culturally realized this was true for the male of the species, that he couldn't handle power, he would abuse it, he would misuse it, he would use it for his own purposes, unless first he'd been taken on a journey of falling. And then the upward takes care of itself. The problem is convincing people about the grace and the necessity and the wonder of falling. In the middle of the book, I have a chapter called Necessary Suffering. I think it was you, Cheryl, who told me, Richard, you have to expand on that notion of necessary suffering. That's why you need a good editor to notice those things you can't see because you're too in sight of it. I talked about necessary suffering, but probably if you hadn't said so, I don't know that I would have devoted a whole chapter to it. And then once I began, it just flowed and was obvious. But anyway, with that as a bit of a preface, let's dive in. The first half of life, now this is just my language, And it's just giving metaphors, because that's the only way you can teach spiritual things, right? The only language we have available to us in the world of religion and spirituality is metaphor, right? And if we would have had that straight, we wouldn't be in the fundamentalist pit that we are today, where people understand spiritual things at such an unbelievably literal and low level. Literalism, as I say in the book and in previous books too, is always the lowest level of meaning. It demands the least conversion, transformation, enlightenment, awareness. You really don't have to know anything except your understanding of words. And then you try to pull the whole world into your understanding of words, which makes the spiritual message extremely limited and small. It's ended up justifying slavery, racism, sexism, classism, homophobia, war itself, because people are satisfied to deal with religion at this first half of life level. Because the first half of life, almost by necessity, and I'll try to explain that, is sort of fundamentalist, sort of black and white. And you see this, any of you who are mothers and fathers, in your little 8-year-old girl and 10-year-old boy. They can't deal with subtlety. They don't need it. They really don't. They need the rules. They feel great comfort when they know at least what the rules are, even if they don't like them. We find out it gives a certain psychic comfort to know who's in, who's out, what the rules of the game are, who the winners are, and who the losers are. We know this is built on what I called in the last book, The Naked Now, the binary system of the mind, that the mind knows by comparison. It knows ideas in comparison to another idea. And if you stay simply at the level of words and ideas, you remain, in terms of what I call, a dualistic thinker. That's the vast majority of the human race. Never gets beyond thinking words are reality, right? And substituting words for reality. Because I have the right words, I'm an Orthodox Christian or Jew or anything else. Because I think I'm educated, I can presume I'm also enlightened. So what we want to say from the beginning, and some of you have heard me say before, education and enlightenment are two different things. And the church itself, which should have known better, has often had them confused. Just because we gave people catechism classes or Sunday school or indoctrinated them in a certain form of words, we assume they were spiritual people and in the second half of life. Probably not true. So, the first half of life, using my metaphor, is largely building your container. For some reason, people have found that word helpful. It's a necessary container whereby you have created, largely by your own culture, parenting, education, background, and limited experience, your own boundaries, identity, and ego structure. I am this, and I am not that. That's, you see it in little 3- and 4-year-old kids. The little girl is so eager to self-identify as a girl. The little boy is so eager to self-identify as a boy. Not in all cases, but in most. And we sort of understand that. And if they're doing it properly by our understanding, that's why we can't deal with the exceptions very well, we surely encourage them to build that ego structure by our cultural definition, and it usually is largely cultural, of what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a man. But then we find other distinctions. What does it mean to be an American? And the only way we can understand that is to find out who our enemies are. Who is not American? And so we compare to that. It builds you a nice little container. There's not much depth to it. There's not much breadth to it. frankly, there's not much truth to it in terms of metaphysical, ontological, theological, spiritual truth, but you gotta do it. And then we take it further. We look, I did too, you all did too, for what you're good at. And you flow with your natural expertise and gifts. And this makes people praise you and like you and affirm you and pat you on the back and give you I am special buttons, as I often say, for not being very special at all. But you've got to do it, all right? And we parents and educators are glad to do it because you've got to have a few successes to build your container. Now, the trouble is, after you've invested 15, 25 years in it, advertising why your gender is best and your country is best and your skills are best and your religion is best. I didn't get to that one yet, which often ends up being the biggest problem of all because it invariably limits God and takes away God's freedom to do whatever God wants. We end up telling God who God can like and who God is allowed to save. And it's sort of unbelievable. But that's what happens when you stay inside of your container. It's by definition egocentric, narcissistic, self-referential. You can only look out at reality from your pair of eyes. And how else can you start? And God surely understands that. You look at it with you as the reference point. How does it affect me? Does it promote me? Does it protect me? Now we know that those early levels of consciousness are largely security-based. I was actually thinking this morning as I read a newspaper headline how there seems to be no limit to what military forces can ask from taxes or government or And that's never called into question. We can be as in debt as we are, but we'll call everything else into question, revealing the higher levels of consciousness, arts or education, but not security. Why? Because that's the first level of consciousness. It's the first in the hierarchy of needs. I've got to feel safe. And people who remain at the first level never get beyond the morality of what we unkindly called in the last few years soccer moms, you know. Nothing against mothers who love their children playing soccer, but it came to connote a total preoccupation with the welfare of my world, my child, my fun, and not much vision beyond that. It's not bad, but it is just the first half of life. That's my point. And I'm convinced, as Ken Wilber and others have said, the huge function of religion, apart from uniting us to God and everything else, which is its goal, is in fact to grease the wheels of consciousness and evolution so people move from the first half of life to the second half of life. That's the function. And here I am a priest, but I had to say it in several ways in the book. I don't think we're doing our job. In fact, the overwhelming experience of worldwide religion today is that it keeps people in the first half of life. And in fact, tells them that the first half of life is the whole journey. By giving you undeserved salvation theories, undeserved sense of enlightenment and superiority and security, which satisfies that low-level need. So you can walk around feeling you're saved, you're going to heaven. This, of course, is a very good day to talk about this, as you know. Since the world is going to end at 6 o'clock this afternoon, Eastern Daylight Time. So you only have a few hours left. I don't know why you even came to this talk. But this is what fundamentalist religion tries to do. It tries to take back the control. And if we're not here after six, forgive me but for making fun of this. But the arrogance of the mind when it cannot surrender to mystery, it just wants to take control and absolute control. to be able to predict the end of the world and the exact time, American time, by the way, because we're, of course, the empire. I hope you other countries all know that, that God has shed his grace on this country, right? Because we look out at life from this country. What's happening in consciousness, and this says religion is, in some cases, doing its job, is more and more people have rightly suffered the necessary suffering. The middle chapters of the book, after I talk about the first half of life, is the tragic sense of life, which Jesus called the way of the cross, by the way. Necessary suffering, stumbling over the stumbling stone. I almost wonder if the pain and the tragedy and the absurdity of this last century has not forced a necessary stumbling stone in the front of a lot of people's path. And the easy answers of the Enlightenment and of modernism all had fallen apart by the late 60s. They fell apart earlier in Europe because Europe had suffered so much from sort of nonstop war in Christian Europe. We pushed it off, we Americans, as long as we could. We don't stumble unless we have to. Americans are not into falling, all right? We're into succeeding. We like the upward part. We don't like the falling part. But what religion is saying at the more mature levels is there is no upward without falling. Now, the Christian word for that was the Paschal mystery, that death and life are in an eternal embrace and don't dare define any aspect of life, any, outside of that frame. If you do, you're living in untruth. You're living in illusion. If you try to create a world of resurrection without death, without falling, without crucifixion, without failing and suffering. Now, nothing, brothers and sisters, in our common sense wants to believe that. It has to come with the force of a divine revelation. Are every one of us in this room and watching on internet will resist it, will think, I can get around it. If I'm just clever enough, if I just make enough money, right? If I just have enough fun or enough sex, or I will not have to go down. Or what religious people think, which is why religion is so dangerous, and I mean that sincerely, if I just do it right, I won't have to fall. You see, religion itself can be a very egocentric plan for eternal climbing. And never being wrong, religious people are not known for liking to be wrong, right? We've been trained that the very goal is to always, always be right. And in fact, the ones that God loves and the ones that God is going to reward are those who are always right. So you see how a misreading of the gospel itself led us to avoid its central message. And we ended up using God, the gospel, Jesus himself, as another way to climb, another way to be a little better than everybody else. Nothing in us wants to believe that we should or have to go in any way down. We have to be led there. To be honest, we largely have to be forced there. Who of you would go? Willingly, I wouldn't. You stumble into it. It's a necessary falling by circumstances and life events and relationships that, dang it, just don't work out. Despite all of your best education and religion and effort and willpower and intelligence, it still ends up failing and falling. Now, any of you who are spiritual directors, you know when someone comes into you with that kind of failure or falling experience, even though you want to empathize with their pain, there's a little leap of the heart inside because you're inwardly sort of halfway delighted. You can't say that first of all. You can't say, oh, this is just wonderful that your first marriage is falling apart. And of course, I'm not here to encourage first marriages to fall apart, but for some people, it will probably be the only way they will ever grow up. The only way they'll ever learn how to love. The only way they'll ever get beyond the first level of consciousness. To have their little salvation project, as Thomas Merton so cleverly called it, to have their little salvation project fall apart. For 3 years, I taught up here at Hamus Springs, which in the early years was the one place in the United States that was trying to address the issue of pedophilia before it became a national scandal. And I remember working with a number of priests and brothers, some who were rightly accused and some who were falsely accused. But again and again in the agony that these men went through, I discovered an amazing amount of men who had been priests for years, but finally became spiritual. And their priesthood was almost an avoidance of the actual spiritual journey. They just had the right words, but never really the inner experience of grace. Was it a tragedy? Yes, for them, and apparently in some cases for other people. In the great scheme, in the big picture that Jesus calls the reign of God, probably it was not a tragedy at all. As about as counterintuitive as you can get. So life is going to offer you this anyway. And what the gospel does, rightly understood, is prepare you for that ahead of time. And so when it happens, you don't look for somebody to sue or somebody to blame or somebody to hate or a group to now abandon because they were all wrong. But you're held usually for a period of years. I'm going to risk talking chronologically. And this is dangerous, I admit. Some of you saw just yesterday on Oprah Winfrey, the little 11-year-old Maddie Stepanak, you know, who at 11 years old seemed to clearly be in the second half of life, right, before he died. And she said he's even up for canonization now. You know? How can someone 11 years of old be so aware? And yet we all know people my age who are spiritually, emotionally, psychologically infantile. We've seen some of them in the news lately. I won't mention names, huh? Who have money and power and success at every level, but live in total narcissism, huh? Have spent so much time building, protecting their own container that they really can't see beyond it to anything except what's good for me. So I want to throw that in right away, that this is not chronological as such. But after saying that, I'm going to say that largely, most people stumble over the stumbling stones between 35 and 55, all right? That's when your salvation project should, I hope, I pray, fall apart for you, all right? And if it doesn't, or if you don't allow it, and many people don't, there's two groups that Jesus seems to name as especially avoidant of the second half of life. And those are the people he calls the rich, and secondly, the people we would call religious. Richness and religion end up being the greatest defenses against the whole journey. And so avoid all of them at all costs, right? Because at the lowest levels, they can keep you feeling very, very superior while not being superior at all. Not being aware, not being conscious, not being connected, or not being in love. So the gospel told us Christians that there is inherently a tragic sense to life. that it is not a straight line forward, that it is much more three steps forward, two steps backward, huh? But that the three steps finally win out. And that's called a Christian hope. That's called the resurrection. That's called grace. That's called our cosmic trust in the future, which for us became symbolized by the risen Christ. So you're almost burdened with being an optimist, that this falling is upward. But when you're in the middle of it, of course, it doesn't feel that way. Now, let me stop right at that point and point out the myth I used throughout the book as sort of the skeleton. Because I knew, and nor did I want to just be preaching to the choir and talking to people who are already bona fide religious folk, there's not much point in doing that. Because very often they're the most blocked against the further journey. So I wanted to appeal to other sources, and particularly mythology. Because as many of you know, I'm convinced that sacred myths found in all cultures only endured, only were told again and again and again, and passed the test of centuries, because they were subliminally and always true. You don't keep telling stories over and over again unless down here they're resonating. Now, these stories, as many of you know, and I did a webcast on this last year, is Homer's Odyssey, written about 700 years before Christ by a Greek poet whom we would have called in my early education a pagan, someone who was unfortunately unenlightened and lost and didn't know Jesus. And of course, that itself becomes a revelation of how small we've made our God. If God was only waiting for Roman Catholics to appear before God could start loving, or evangelicals who seem to believe the same thing, right? Then, you know, God hasn't had much to do in most of history. Just been waiting on cloud nine. The Stone Age people were throwaway people, you know. The Egyptian Empire, the Persian Empire. All of those people didn't matter to God. Just those Greeks didn't matter. Homer was a waste of time, you know. So why would we bother with him? God was just waiting for Christians to come along. This new select club who really would love him. Revealing God's narcissism almost, that God can only love people who loved him perfectly and had his name right and were sure that he was a he too. And if you got all those, maybe you were in the club. So God's love ends up being not unconditional by any definition, but highly, highly conditional. God does not love his enemies, even though Jesus commands us to. So you've got a major disconnect at the foundation of the whole mythology, because God's telling you to love your enemies, but in fact, I don't. I hate them and I torture them for all eternity. Brothers and sisters, you've got to know this is an unworkable mythology, all right? Absolutely unworkable. We'll never create mystics, saints, generous-hearted people, because they're basically afraid of God, and don't trust God, and if they'd be honest, don't even like God, because God is so petty and so small. Now, forgive me for throwing that little sermon in, but I have to do it if we're going to be able to honor other sources of wisdom and to realize what Thomas Aquinas said in the 13th century is true. And he said this, the only question is not who said it, where did it come from, but is it true? And if it's true, Aquinas said, it is always from the Holy Spirit. If it's true, it's always from the Holy Spirit. And the first question is not, did a Protestant write it? Right? Did an American write it? Did a man write it? Did a woman write it? The only question is it true? But that takes some non-dual thinking to think that way, and that's second half of life. And if most history hasn't gotten to the second half of life, and I don't think they have, you realize they can't frame reality except in terms of reward and punishment. Good guys and bad guys, just like your 10-year-old boy. And we like 10-year-old boys. They're cute as can be, but you don't put them in charge of countries, all right? Or you don't make them leaders of churches, right? Because they have nowhere to lead you. By definition, a leader should be a second half of life person. A person who says, there's something more. There's something bigger. Which is, of course, the language of God. So, back to Homer. Homer wrote the story of this man, Odysseus, in Latin, Ulysses, who fought the Trojan War, and that was the Iliad. But the even more favorite part of his two-part book became Odysseus's journey home from the Trojan War. And you know what? It wasn't a straight line. And if you look at a map, to get across the Aegean Sea isn't very far. But in fact, it took him apparently 20 years. I mean, does this begin to sound like the Jewish narrative of 40 years through the desert? Of course, because it's the same story. It's the same big story, that life is a spiral, life is three steps forward, two steps backward, and you get there almost in spite of yourself. Just as the Jews were led by Yahweh, Odysseus is both led by the gods, male and female gods, and also fought by them, which is a marvelous understanding of how mystery works. We experience it on our side and also somehow blocking us and opposing us. That's a very good description of the journey. Now, at a certain point on his return, in fact, a point interestingly named Hades, which became sort of a correlative of our understanding of hell, but it certainly means not a place of eternal punishment, but when you're at the bottom, when it doesn't make sense, when it's all absurd, when you've lost everything as he has at that point. When Odysseus is in Hades, just as in the Jewish scriptures, a prophet appears. And his name, he's found in other Greek mythologies, is Tiresias. And Tiresias tells him something at the bottom of his journey that he's only half able to hear. In fact, he hardly is interested in the message. He tells him, you will get home to Ithaca. He is the king of Ithaca. It's an island kingdom. And he tells him, you will get back there, although you have many trials. But actually, when you get back there and make love to your wife Penelope, and your son Telemachus greets you with great joy, and you see your father Laertes before he dies, and even your little dog Argos wags his tail one time, beautiful story, it will not be a happy ever after story. In fact, Odysseus, you will have to go on a further journey. Well, it's a throwaway memory. He forgets it. He gets back on the journey home to Ithaca and hardly remembers and is hardly interested, as probably most of us, in any kind of further journey. Because we're all taking care of our first journey, aren't we? His first journey is beautifully symbolized by the oar, O-A-R, because he has been rowing across the Aegean Sea. The ship has been his occupation and his job. So sure enough, to jump over much of the story, Odysseus finally gets home. And there, after making love to his wife Penelope, greeting his son, seeing again his father, and loving his dog, he remembers, my gosh, this is not the end. I must go on a further journey. And then he remembers what Tiresias told him. You are to take your oar and put it on your shoulder. and return to the mainland. Now, I'm probably psychologizing this too much, but here you have one who has become the king of his separate island, right? His autonomous self. This separate self that we all think we are, as long as we stay in the first half of life. We over-defend it. We over-promote it. We over-feed it and futurize it. And so we think that's all there is. But he says you have to take your oar and return to the mainland. I take the mainland as the joining of the common field, the unified field, the communion of saints, the connection with everybody else. Everything belongs. That's the second half of life, where you've stopped doing your private survival dance. Why I'm special. Why I'm important. Why I cannot die. Why God loves me more than everybody else. Huh? That's all first half of life stuff. The second half of life, to use Bill Plotkin's marvelous phrase, you move beyond your survival dance to your real sacred dance. I don't know how many people get there, but very often, and this is what retirement should mean, it means you've got to plant your oar, your occupation. You've got to go beyond making money and defining yourself by your occupation and your job. That's just not what life is about. Who would tell us that in a capitalist country? Now we're concerned about how can I make more money even when I'm retired by investing it here and there. So my money makes money. It's not a matter of serving the world or making the world a better place after I leave it. It's simply extended taking care of myself. And we all sort of take this even for granted. Shows that we're not much smarter than Homer was, who wasn't able to describe the further journey, but he deeply intuited it. When I first began to really believe this was true was on my first trip to India. It must have been almost 30 years ago. And I was taken to a church in Bangalore. And there were only four windows in the church, not the usual stained glass windows of Western churches, which have scenes from the Bible, but in fact, four scenes in the four windows of the church that I didn't recognize. I said, well, this must not be Catholic. I don't even see Jesus in the windows. And they said, oh, these are the four seasons of human life, going back to ancient Hinduism. And do know the Hindu religion is first of all a culture before it was ever a religion, and the oldest culture in the world. People who've observed the mystery of life and death much longer than we ever have, and have come up with a kind of amazing wisdom that we're only rediscovering in the hospice movement today, where people are again observing life and death at close range. At any rate, here are the four windows. The first one is called the student, the young man, and it was male in these windows. The young man setting off on his journey with excitement to discover himself, to go to school, carrying his books, to be smart, to get educated. That makes sense to all of us. The second window was called the householder. And the householder is the man who marries, has his children, creates a job for himself, an occupation, makes money to support those children and that wife. Most of us would see that as the last window, I think. We just grow old doing that. But there's little knowledge of the third or the fourth window at all. Little real knowledge of it, even in the world of religion. Even after Jesus approached the first disciples who already had their family and their occupation and their nets, and he said to James and John and Peter and Andrew, leave it. So this is in our own scriptures. Leave this world of self-defined security and occupation for something that has really no security, no definition, no clear goal right now, for something that I will show you. So this is founded in our own Christian scriptures. It's amazing. But we thought he was calling him to join the Roman Catholic Church. Do you understand? Yeah. Wasn't talking about a further journey or to become a Baptist, you know, or to get some water poured over your head, you know. This doesn't assure a second journey at all. In fact, the pouring of water can, in fact, be a confirmation that you've already done it, that your first journey is the only journey. You see how much we're capable of missing the point when we stay at the level of literalism instead of really understanding what the journey is about. So he tells him, take his oar, go back to the mainland, and just keep marching inland until a wayfarer, as he's described, will spot you. And he will, talk about brilliant metaphor. He says, the wayfarer will confuse your oar with a winnowing fan, or what's sometimes translated, even in Matthew's gospel, as a winnowing shovel. Now, knowing that most people in human history were agrarian and saw what happened in the fields before we had harvesters and combines, and in every village to survive, there had to be people who constantly separated with winnowing fans the wheat from the chaff. Let's just call it, for our purposes, the essentials from the non-essentials. The real from the unreal. What matters from what doesn't matter at all. Now, a lot of people we find are not getting this, and again, I'm learning this from the hospice people. A lot of people are not getting this message of distinguishing the essentials from the non-essentials till the last 5 weeks, 5 days, 5 hours, and even in some cases, last 5 minutes of life. I'm calling it, others are calling it, enlightenment at gunpoint, right? We push off this giving up of our oar and discovering the winnowing fan till the last 5 minutes of life. What matters and what doesn't matter at all. As I love to say it now, salvation for me anymore is not a question of if. It's clear to me God loves everything that God created and is calling it back to himself, herself. The only question is when? When do you get it? When do you get what's real and what's unreal? What matters and what doesn't matter at all? And what religion was meant to do was to help you get it earlier, earlier. Wake up. And die before you die, so you don't have to wait for enlightenment at gunpoint 5 hours before you die. And then, as they invariably say, why didn't I recognize 50 years ago that love is the only thing that matters? Huh? And who will my China go to now? Who will my wonderful house go to now? My car that's better than everybody else's car, who will it go to now? All of that in a moment means nothing, 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 nothing. That's second half of life wisdom. That's non-dual wisdom. That's something you can know chronologically in the first half of life if you're willing to do the falling, the dying before you die. Now, again, this is why I don't have to apologize as a Christian or for Jesus. That verse that all of us have heard and shuddered before, where he says, unless you die to yourself, you cannot know what it's really about. The word that's used there is as strong as, and probably should be translated as, you must renounce yourself. It's the same thing the Buddhists are saying. This autonomous, separate little thing that you're making the whole container and you overly defend and overly promote and overly protect, it's going to die anyway. So renounce it ahead of time and stop trying to make it the best looking container in Albuquerque or the most Catholic container in the Roman Catholic Church. At that point, it's all about you and your superiority. That's why it has to be renounced. It has to die. By the way, for those of you who have a spiritual practice like contemplation or meditation, that's what you're doing. For 20 minutes, you're dying to it. You're refusing to identify with your thinking mind, your emotions that want to defend yourself. You're saying, that's not me. I'm going to go deeper. So any spiritual practice is basically, if it's an authentic spiritual practice, is a preparation to push you into the second half of life. If it isn't doing that, it's not a good spiritual practice. What is my church doing now, right? We're readjusting the words of the Mass involving meetings and reprintings of the sacramentary, and now we got to re-educate all you laity to have the new and proper responses that are from the original Latin. And of course, we know that Jesus never spoke Latin. And in fact, Latin was the language of his oppressors. So what's the idea? What's the point? Well, it's the best you can worry about when you're in the first half of life, even as an institution. Now, if you think I'm being unfair or even trying to be unkind, that's not my point. As Spiral Dynamics is saying, institutions as institutions. So don't get upset or angry or disappointed. It applies to the American government, to the military, and even to the church. Institutions as institutions can normally not operate beyond level 3, right? In a 9-level system, right? They have to be self-protective, self-maintaining, self-promoting, self-defending, self-referential. And could you expect anything different? If we haven't taught you as individuals how to be transformed, how to move to the second half of life, why would you expect institutions to be any different? Because they're peopled with first half of life people. And in fact, the way you get promoted, even in the church, is by being a loyal first half of life person. That doesn't make them bad. We all have to do the first half of life. And I want to say as strongly as I can, if you don't do the first half of life, and some of you are going to hate me for saying it, but if you don't learn about loyalty and obedience and law and limiting your infantile grandiosity by once in a while listening to somebody beyond yourself, I don't think you get easily to the second half of life. You have to know the rules and obey the rules before you know how to disobey the rules properly. It's that simple, right? And so I'm not talking about creating rebels, which I know a lot of young people just revel in. Oh, we can throw out all the institutions. We can throw out everybody because I'm a second half of life person. If you haven't limited your grandiosity, right, by obedience to tradition, law, structure, other people's needs, other people's rights, which is the necessary task of the first half of life, don't tell me you're an enlightened person, right? As Ken Wilber and the Spiral Dynamics people say, the great principle, I think I quote it 3 times in the book, is transcend and include. All transcendence always includes the previous stages. And if you haven't done the previous stages, don't think you're a high-level person. That I don't need the law, I don't need tradition, I don't need authority, I don't need structure, I don't need anything, it's just me. What are you? You're right back into the private self, do you see? This has been, and I have to say it for the sake of fairness, the great Achilles heel of most liberal people. Of most progressive, educated, enlightened people. They've got a certain degree of enlightenment, but just enough to get them to level 4, right? This is not yet the non-dual wisdom, the holiness, the transformative, all-inclusive, all-compassionate thinking you see in the mystics and the saints who never throw out the baby with the bathwater. They always say, that was good. Wilber, who so often says things in shocking ways to get your attention, he says, now don't walk out, he says, everybody is right. I can't imagine saying that to Pope Benedict, you know? But I'd love to if he'd give me time to explain it, you know? Everybody is right. What's he mean by that, huh? Yeah, Benedict would have to call it relativism from his system. And I understand his system. And I was trained in his system. And I respect why he has to say that, right? But I also can respect why other people have to say something else. And I can say, you're right at this level. And you're right at this level. You've got to understand levels of consciousness. And that's what religion, at its more mature levels, was able to do. Was able to affirm people in the law, and at the same time, calling people to mystic freedom. I always find it hard. You know, here I was lucky enough to be able to write a whole book. But on Sunday, like here at the local parish, I'll have Mass this afternoon at 4:30. I'll be dressed just like every other priest, and I hope do it according to form, all right? And I'll give an 8-minute homily, and in that 8 minutes, I've somehow got to hit right at the middle. I got to not go beyond the people who would be totally shocked or scandalized. I won't say everybody is right, and I have to challenge those who are farther on. Have to move from your preoccupation with your role, your title, your job, your occupation, to move to the level of inner wisdom. And when even the outsiders can see that, when they don't look at you for your oar anymore, but for your winnowing fan, then you've got something to say. You're a second half of life person. And of course, those are the second two windows. The third window is called in Hindu mythology the forest dweller. It's the one who leaves his occupation, her occupation, to wander into bigger worlds beyond my country, my religion, my ethnicity, my gender, my whatever you've hidden behind. To say, is there a bigger world that I can move into? Now, the fact that we don't even naturally understand that, I think, speaks to the first half of life nature of our culture. The closest we have is retirement. And even that has been a shield for many people, for a highly narcissistic lifestyle, that they end their final years not in giving back, paying back, volunteering, serving the world, but just, you know, more and more elaborate vacations. And we live in a culture where that's taken for granted. If that's supposed to be the meaning of your 60s and your 70s, we don't understand the second half of life, that's all. And the final window is the sage, or the holy man, the holy woman, where you've moved to total non-dual wisdom, where everything really can belong, where you can live with a kind of inclusivity, a kind of freedom, that if you are able to operate as an elder in your family, in your neighborhood, in your church, just by your existence, and this is what I talk about in the later chapters of the book, by your very being, by what you say and what you don't say, what you have to say and what you don't need to say, you pull groups forward. And we call our men's work men as learners and elders, with this recognition that at least in the male world, there's a desperate need for true elders, for father figures who have something to say to the sons, and of course, mother figures who have something to say to the daughters. So in short, this is what we're talking about. These are the two halves of life. We'll have time for question afterwards, but I hope this lays a foundation. 10-minute break. Thank you all. Thank you.